Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. Our lead story today concerns how global warming is affecting the entire planet. About 2 weeks ago, the world watched in horror as a gigantic piece of Antarctica broke off the Larsen Ice Shelf Sea. However, now we're witnessing the degradation of Australia's Great Barrier Reef. 50% of the Great Barrier Reef may in fact be lost, according to recent satellite data just released. Also, Elon Musk is making the news once again. Not only is he the pioneer behind Tesla Motors and the electric car, also SpaceX and the reusable rocket, he's now beginning to make statements that, well, sort of backpedal some of his previous optimism about going to Mars. So we're going to talk about speed bumps on the way to Mars. Elon Musk says our astronauts have to be brave. In other words, they have to face the fact that they may not come back. And also, speaking about Elon Musk, he also addressed a conference recently talking about the dangers of artificial intelligence. What happens when the robots take over? What happens when we have Terminator-like killing machines that rampage through civilization? So we'll say a few things about the benefits and also the downside of artificial intelligence. How dangerous are robots anyway? And then news from someplace that resembles Star Trek. Well, Star Trek, of course, talked about teleportation. And here's a new press release from China. Chinese physicists have been able to teleport information 870 miles into outer space, from Tibet to a satellite orbiting the planet Earth. Now, does that mean that one day you'll be able to teleport yourself across space and time? Well, the answer is no. But however, progress is being made in something called quantum teleportation. And speaking about Star Trek and science fiction, invisibility is in the news once again. Scientists now realize that, yes, it is physically possible to make an object disappear, just like with the cloaking device in Harry Potter and also Star Trek. But there are some problems. So we'll talk about a new breakthrough being made at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. The possibility of making metallic nanoparticles that can give us partial invisibility. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. A few weeks ago, the world watched in horror as an object the size of the state of Delaware, weighing a trillion tons, slid into the ocean off the coast of Antarctica. The gigantic Larsen Ice Shelf Sea cracked open, and right on national television, you could see huge chunks of ice floating into the ocean, creating one of the world's largest icebergs. And people are concerned about, well, global warming. First of all, let me say that the fact that the Larsen Ice Shelf Sea itself broke off does not raise sea level, because Larsen Ice Shelf Sea was already floating on the water. And there's still debate among climatologists as to how much global warming and human activity contributed to the breakup of Larsen Sea. However, a word to the wise. Climatologists, even though they're divided on the question of how much human activity contributed to the crack-up of Larsen Sea, they are all unified to say that, yes, this is a wake-up call. The stability of the South Pole, once thought to be a given, is no longer guaranteed, as we see gigantic rivers of liquid water flowing underneath the ice cap, which were not seen by satellites, caught catching scientists by surprise, meaning that the polar regions are heating up much faster than the rest of the planet Earth. And then on the other side of the Earth, we have a problem in Australia. The Great Barrier Reef, we knew that it was in danger. You don't have to be a genius to see that the bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef is going to have a tremendous economic and ecological impact. First of all, the industry that depends upon the Great Barrier Reef of Australia is worth $3.7 billion in fishing, tourism, in ecology. In fact, it affects 275 million people. They are dependent upon Great Barrier Reefs and other reefs around the world. And because the temperature of the world is rising, it means that algae is being expelled from the Great Barrier Reef, causing it to bleach.
The problem is that the Great Barrier Reef is a home to thousands of different kinds of species of plants and animals and fish. And the livelihood of the people of the area depends upon that, not to mention tourism. And it's a generator of income, not to mention the fact that it's a barrier that protects inland areas. So in some sense, we're now witnessing the consequence of global warming on a planetary scale. We're witnessing the gradual breakup of parts of the South Pole, and now the degradation of the coral reefs as well. Also, Elon Musk, the entrepreneur behind Tesla Motors and the electric car, the man behind SpaceX, the man who is a prototype for Tony Stark, the mythical hero of the Iron Man comic series, well, he's made statements about going to the planet Mars. First of all, many people think that we're entering a new golden age of space exploration after 45 years of spinning wheels around the planet Earth. Now, our sights are set to planet Mars. President Barack Obama, when he was president years ago, said that by 2030 or so, he expects to see astronauts on the surface of Mars. But now Elon Musk is beginning to backtrack a bit because, of course, there are speed bumps on the way to Mars. Elon Musk is famous for saying that he wants to be buried on Mars, but not on impact. In other words, there's something called the Mars jinx. The Mars jinx basically states that about two-thirds of our space probes never make it to Mars, most of them being Russian. The United States has had a much better track record of sending space probes to Mars. But yeah, there is that Mars jinx. The Europeans have had a hard time going to Mars, for example, as well as the Russians. And the question is, can we send humans reliably into outer space? Well, Elon Musk has the Falcon rocket. The Falcon rocket already made history because it is a reusable rocket. Think of, for example, the used car industry. The used car industry after World War II made it possible for teenagers and GIs to get in that car and be part of the American dream. In fact, the used car industry today is bigger than the new car industry. Think about that. That's how big the used car industry is. Some people think that Elon Musk, with his reusable Falcon rocket, could do the same thing for rocketry. Drive down the cost of rocketry from $10,000 a pound of payload to $1,000 to put a pound of anything into near-Earth orbit. However, as Elon Musk has stated, space travel is no Sunday picnic. And that is, you have to worry about safety. First of all, you have vibrations. Elon Musk wants to take the Falcon rocket and put three of them together, lash three of these rockets together to create a super rocket, the Falcon Heavy. And the Falcon Heavy rocket is sufficiently powerful to go all the way to the planet Mars. Not to be outdone, Amazon.com is now jumping into the game. Jeff Bezos, the pioneer behind Amazon, has already created a spaceport in Texas. That's right. He has personally financed his own spaceport in order to bring tourists to the outer space. Elon Musk has already taken volunteers to go to Mars and volunteers to go to the International Space Station on his rockets. And that's why some people think that we could be entering a new golden age. Well, other people say, bah, humbug. I mean, it's expensive. It's dangerous. And think of all the problems we have here on the planet Earth. Who needs to send rockets out there anyway into deep space? Well, I remember years ago when the Tyros space satellite, the first satellite devoted to monitoring the Earth's weather, went into orbit. The president of the United States back then was Lyndon Baines Johnson, and he had hell to pay. The media was against it. A lot of people were saying, a weather satellite? If you want to know what the weather is, simply lick your finger, point it in the air, and bingo, why do you need a billion-dollar satellite monitoring the Earth's weather in outer space? Well, LBJ was supposed to go on television in order to defend his controversial funding of the Tyra satellite. But I still remember, I'll never forget, that the Tyra satellite, for the first time in world history, photographed a hurricane headed toward the U.S. of A. And we had advance warning. We knew the size of the hurricane. We knew the intensity of the hurricane. We knew more or less where it was going to hit landfall. We could issue evacuation orders. People could reinforce power stations and other kinds of industries. Millions of dollars could be saved. Hundreds, thousands of lives could be put out of harm's way. And I still remember LBJ coming on the evening news that night and said, "Today, the space program has paid for itself." Actually, he was wrong. The space program had more than paid for itself. Because when you take a look at all that weather satellites have given us, it is hundreds of billions of dollars in benefits from outer space. In fact, I think President Barack Obama said it very well. The Human Genome Project cost $3 billion of federal financing to sequence the genome that makes you and me. And how much have we gotten back in return? Many times the original $3 billion investment, which is pittance, peanuts, compared to the benefits that we get from the Human Genome Project. Think about it. When you go to the doctor's office in the future, the first thing they'll do is begin the process of scanning your genes. And think of the new therapies and medicines, the bountiful harvest of new medicines that we have gotten because of the Genome Project. For example, just last week on Exploration, I mentioned a brand new cancer therapy, a therapy that uses genetic engineering to modify our T cells to attack cancer. This is incredible. First of all, our bodies attack cancer all the time. That's right, believe it or not, cancer cells naturally develop in your body, but your body kills them. It has T cells which can recognize these cancer cells. However, cancer cells can mutate. They can change with time. Sooner or later, they mutate so that the protein coat around the cancer cell makes them invisible, invisible to the T cells, your white blood cells that protect you. And what happens? You die. Well, now, using genetic engineering, we can take your T cells, modify them. That's right, genetically modify them so they can recognize cancer cells and zap them. Well, the results have been very encouraging. And if the results hold up, it could mean a new way of attacking cancer. Not just surgery, not just chemotherapy, not just radiation, but genetic engineering, complements of the Human Genome Project, which is just one of thousands of consequences of the $3 billion investment that we made to sequence our human genome. But you may say to yourself, well, you know, technology is not all great. Take a look at what's happening with the job market. And for that matter, look at Elon Musk. He made a statement just last week stating, "Robots, watch out. This could be a turning point in the history of the human race," says physicist Stephen Hawking, "because what happens if one day the robots take over? Well, at least take over our jobs." Well, let's break it down into its components. Where is the danger? When might we expect these dangers? And how bad are these dangers coming from artificial intelligence? First of all, we don't have to fear Terminator-type robots rampaging through our cities anytime soon. Our robots have the intelligence of a bug. That's right, a cockroach. That's about the intelligence of most of our most advanced robots. The Pentagon, in fact, even funded a contest to create a robot that can clean up the disaster at Fukushima. And it was a disaster. Simple tasks like sweeping the floor, turning a valve, driving a car, things that a kid can do, robots fail. So we have a long ways to go. So why is Stephen Hawking and other scientists and Elon Musk beginning to say that we have to watch out for robots? The danger here is automatic killing machines. that is drones that are put on automatic and just keep on killing. For example, today, if you have a drone flying over an area with terrorists, then perhaps there's some high school graduate with a computer screen monitoring what's happening there, identifying targets, and then zapping them with drones like the Hellfire drone. Well, that happens today. What happens tomorrow? What happens tomorrow if there is an accident or a drone is created that can recognize the human shape and execute commands without human intervention? Let's say there's a mishap, and all of a sudden, because it can recognize the human form, it just starts to kill people indiscriminately. These are called automatic killing machines, and yes, that is a danger that we have to face. Not the danger of Terminator-type robots that are autonomous, that are self-aware, but automatic killing machines like drones used on the battlefield. Yes, that's where we should have fail-safe systems. Fail-safe systems where it's very easy to deactivate them if, for example, a mishap takes place and all of a sudden they become automatic killing machines. So that's the immediate danger. Automatic killing machines, treaties have to be signed, weapons have to be modified or junked, but not self-aware Terminator-style robots. So they're perhaps decades away. Right now, our most advanced robots have the intelligence of a cockroach. Eventually, they'll be as intelligent as a mouse, then as smart as a rabbit, then as smart as a cat, dog, and eventually as smart as a monkey. At that point, yeah, they could be potentially dangerous, but that means perhaps by the end of the century, we will have to worry about these super smart monkeys that are super powerful. Perhaps by the end of the century, we may have to worry about self-aware robots. But that means we have plenty of time in which to deal with the question. No one expects autonomous, self-aware robots to walk out of the laboratory anytime soon. That's just not going to happen. Rodney Brooks, the former head of MIT's Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, who we've had on Exploration, he said it very clearly. He said the chance that you're going to get a self-aware robot walking out of somebody's basement, the chance of that happening is about the same as a chance of a whirlwind or a hurricane creating a Boeing 747 jet out of debris. In other words, it's not going to happen anytime soon. But then other people say, well, what about the job market? Yes, certain jobs are going to be eliminated. Let's face it, we don't have blacksmiths anymore. We don't have wagon makers anymore. But we don't cry about it either, because the wagon makers of old, the blacksmiths of old, they became automobile workers. They were retrained to new jobs. And I think personally that eventually, not now, but decades into the future, the robotics industry might be as big as the automobile industry of today. There could be whole industries employing people that are involved in the design, the repair, the manufacture, the improvement of robots. For example, your car. The car of the future could actually be a robot. You'll talk to your car, tell it where to go, argue with the car about the best route to take, and you won't have to buy a car in the future anymore. You'll simply lease it. Because why do you have to buy a car that sits in your garage doing nothing? In the future, you'll talk to your wristwatch and order the car. The car will come, drive you to work. Afterwards, you'll tell the car, park yourself. You're not going to have to worry about parking because cars will park themselves. Afterwards, you'll call for the car again after work, drive home, and then tell the car, park yourself. So in the future, we might lease cars rather than buy cars because we're not going to have to park them or worry about them when we're not using them at all. And so in other words, the point is that your car could become a robot as part of a much larger industry of artificially intelligent robots. And then the question is, well, what jobs are going to be replaced by robots? Well, let's be blunt about this. Jobs that are unskilled and repetitive will be eliminated. For example, in the garment industry, in the automobile industry, jobs that are repetitive, because we forget that robots are adding machines. They do the same thing over and over and over again, a million times faster than you, and they do it better than you. So jobs that are dirty, dull, dangerous, Those are the jobs that could be replaced in the coming years. Jobs that are repetitive, dull, that are dirty, cleaning up the sewage system, for example, picking up garbage, and dangerous, for example, defusing explosives or working at sensitive construction sites. Dirty, dull, dangerous jobs will be replaced in the coming decades. So what jobs are going to be available? Well, we realize that robots have certain weak spots, and that's where the jobs of the future will lie. The first weak spot is interfacing with humans. Robots don't understand human values. They can't talk to us very well. You can't gossip with them. And that's why lawyers will have jobs in the future, because lawyers have to argue before a jury. They have to argue before a judge. You have to understand human sensibilities and mores and ethics, things that change constantly. We will have lawyers as a consequence. We'll have doctors in the future because, yes, robots will be able to diagnose simple diseases. But ultimately, life and death decisions depends on people with knowledge, experience, know-how, savvy to expect the unexpected, things that are not necessarily in textbooks. That's why we will have to have doctors in the future. And believe it or not, gardeners. Every garden is different because pattern recognition is the other weak spot of artificial intelligence. Robots can see. They can see much better than you. However, they don't understand what they are seeing. When they see a table, they see lines, circles, squares. They don't understand tableness. When they walk into a room, they only see lines, circles, squares, ovals, ellipses, rectangles. They don't see chair, vase, human, doorway, carpet, rug. No, they don't understand those things. Also, robots can hear much better than you, but they don't understand what they are hearing. They don't understand simple common sense. For example, that water is wet. Well, robots don't know water is wet. Why can't water be dry? Because there's no line in a mathematics textbook that says that water has to be wet. Or strings can pull, strings cannot push. Well, everybody knows that. Every kid knows that. But robots don't know that. Robots have never pulled on a string. They've never pushed on a stick. Sticks can push, but sticks cannot pull. Robots don't know that. And so jobs that involve common sense. So let's list some of the jobs that we're going to have and some of the jobs that we're not going to have. For example, gardeners, sanitation workers, because, yeah, it's very difficult for robots to pick up garbage because every piece of garbage is different, requiring very advanced pattern recognition. Construction workers, because every construction site is different. When you put a robot in a construction site, and what does it do? It gets lost. It can't recognize hammers and saws and people and construction and cranes. Nope, that's way beyond the ability of artificial intelligence. Also, police will have jobs because every crime is different. Not to mention the fact that the police have to outsmart the criminal, and criminals are not stupid. So it means that policemen will have jobs in the future. So you begin to get the point. The point is that unskilled, repetitive jobs, they're going to go out the window. But jobs that are semi-skilled, like a plumber, like a handyman, things that require skills, they're going to be around for quite a while because robots are very bad at pattern recognition and they're bad at common sense. And as Tony Blair likes to say, England derives more revenue from rock and roll than the coal mining industry. When you think of a British worker, you often think of a coal miner. However, you don't think of the rock and roll industry being bigger than the coal mining industry. So intellectual capital will gradually replace commodity capital. For example, today you had breakfast that the King of England could not have had 100 years ago. Think of what you had for breakfast. That's how cheap food has become, because food is a commodity that can be mass-produced, better containerization, better shipping, competition, which drives down the cost of commodities. But intellectual capital, that's going to be the currency of the future. That means creativity, imagination, telling a joke, writing a novel, doing a science experiment. All these things involve intellectual capital, which robots are very bad at. And let's say a few things about the news, science news, including news from Star Trek. In Star Trek, we have something called a teleporter. And it turns out that, well, in China, they made a new advance in teleportation. We can now do something called quantum teleportation. We cannot teleport Captain Kirk, but we can teleport information. And the Chinese have a new record. 870 miles, they teleported a message from Tibet all the way to a satellite in outer space. 870 miles off the surface of the Earth. However, it's quantum teleportation. It's not real teleportation. We did not teleport an atom. We teleported the information of that atom into outer space, and eventually we'll do it to the moon. Now, to do real teleportation, that is to teleport people, that is way beyond our capability. And speaking about science fiction, at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, a new breakthrough was made concerning invisibility. It turns out that invisibility is actually possible within the laws of physics, but you have to manipulate what are called nanoparticles. That is, particles the size of molecules, in order to make light bend in a way that you want to. Think of being in a river, and there's a boulder upstream. Water goes around the boulder and then goes downstream and hits you, and you are unaware of the fact that there's a boulder upstream. Now replace the boulder with the object you want to make invisible and replace the water with light beams. If you can make light go around your object and you were to look at the object, you would see what is behind the object, not the object itself. Is that possible? Well, the answer is actually yes. However, it takes nanoparticles and nanotechnologies to achieve this. And at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor just last week, it was announced that by spraying on metallic nanoparticles, they might be able to induce this effect. In other words, they might be able to give partial invisibility. Now, of course, the Pentagon is interested in this because the Pentagon has spent billions perfecting the stealth bomber. And this is even better than the stealth bomber. This is real invisibility. When are we going to have it? Well, we don't know. Of course, the devil is in the details. And we simply don't know when we might have true invisibility, a la Harry Potter. However, it's always nice to speculate about these things. But ultimately, it's a matter of nanotechnology. Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. And speaking about robots, what about the far future? When robots do begin to approach human intelligence and perhaps even exceed human intelligence, and perhaps they'll be able to recreate copies of themselves which are even more intelligent than the previous generation. Well, that's called the singularity. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on the dean of Singularity, and that is Ray Kurzweil. Ray Kurzweil not only works for Google, but he's a futurist, and he tries to predict many of the trends which are going to affect the way we live and work. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Radio at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we summarized some of the top stories in science, including, well, the journey to Mars, and also a warning that perhaps one day the machines will become so intelligent that maybe they'll replace us, or at least replace some of our jobs. Well, in the short term, what are we going to do about it? One thing we can do is stress education. Technology doesn't wait for anybody. You can't stop technology. It's like sweeping back the ocean. But you can't adjust to it. First priority should be education. To educate workers so they can retrain for jobs involving robotics. For example, I personally believe that one day the robotics industry may be bigger than the automobile industry. Thousands, millions of jobs involved in the creation, the repair, the design, the manufacture of robots. In fact, your car will become a robot in the future, meaning that the automobile industry will be a subset of the robotics industry of the future. Second, we have to create new kinds of jobs for workers. For example, baby boomers are aging. So why not create new biotech jobs that are involved in the medical industry? The city of Pittsburgh, for example, was hit very hard with the collapse of the steel industry. But Pittsburgh basically reinvented itself as being the center for high tech and also biotech, especially as the baby boomers begin to retire. And the baby boomers, of course, are not poor. They have tremendous amounts of disposable income, and a lot of that is going to go into medical care. And third, research. Because, of course, it was the transistor and the laser, two inventions pioneered by physicists that helped to unleash the revolution that we are experiencing here today. And so new research, and this means government financing for speculative kinds of research that may eventually create the next transistor or the next laser beam. However, what happens in the far future when perhaps robots become really smart? At that point, we may have to worry about them because they may have self-awareness. At that point, they may realize that, well, why should they have to slave so much when us humans benefit from all their labors? Well, with us today is Ray Kurzweil, author of the book, The Singularity is Near. Also, he works for the Google Corporation, so people listen to what he has to say. And so today we're going to talk about the singularity. What happens when robots become really smart and they start to have progeny even smarter than they? What happens then? Mr. Kurzweil, the first question for you is, how did you first get interested in robots and artificial intelligence?
I've actually had in mind being an inventor since I was at the age of 5. And age of 12, I discovered computers. I built some primitive computers myself and got access to one as part of a summer job, and quickly became fascinated with the ability to kind of model the world, albeit primitively at that time, in the computer and create virtual realities, and also model our thinking processes. Quickly became interested actually in pattern recognition, which is my view is the fundamental basis of human intelligence rather than logical, sequential, analytical thinking. And a project I did in high school was to build pattern recognition models of melodies, and I would feed in the melodies of Mozart or Chopin, and it would build a pattern recognition model and then write original melodies in the same style from that model, which were recognizable, kind of sounded like second-rate compositions from a second-rate student of Chopin and Mozart. And that started really a lifelong fascination in pattern recognition, which is really my primary technical field.
Okay, and let's talk about your book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. First of all, what is a spiritual machine? Is that a contradiction in terms?
The primary concept of spirituality is really consciousness. If we consider a being or an entity to be conscious, then we consider it to have spiritual value. And if you look at all the different religious traditions, what they really mean by a soul and by spiritual reality is consciousness, an entity that really has subjective experience and can feel pain and joy, as opposed to just the conventional concept of a machine, which is operating by some kind of automatic process. And we don't worry much today about causing pain and suffering to our computer programs. But our computer software is still millions of times simpler than the human brain, we do find, if we look at the human brain, that we actually can model it with great precision neurons and even substantial clusters of neurons. We can talk more about that. And we will have machines, which is to say non-biological entities, that do have the complexity and richness and depth of the human brain, indeed modeled on the principles of operation of the human brain within a few decades. And when these entities claim to be conscious, to be joyful, fearful, angry, and so on, unlike, let's say, the computer characters in video games today, those entities, a few decades from now, will be as convincing as humans. They'll have all the subtle emotional cues that we associate with somebody really having those subjective experiences. So are they conscious? Some philosophers will say, no, they're not squirting human neurotransmitters. You can't be conscious if you're not biological. But there won't be any clear distinction. We won't be able to separate them from any kind of objective observation. And my prediction, and this is really not a philosophical statement, but a psychological and political prediction, is that the bulk of humans, unenhanced humans, will consider these non-biological entities to be conscious. In any event, they'll be very intelligent. They'll be able to convince us that they're conscious, and they'll get angry at us if we don't believe them. And it'll be an actual political and legal issue as well. In my view, the real issue of consciousness is not something we can resolve scientifically, because science involves third-party objective observation. Consciousness is inherently first-party subjective experience, and there is a gap there. Some people go on to say, well, since it's not scientific, it's not an important question. I would turn that around and say it's really a very fundamental question. It shows that there is a need for philosophy outside of science. But these will become real compelling questions as opposed to just abstract philosophical debate in this 21st century.
Okay, and let's talk about the past first as a guide to the future. Back in the 1950s and 60s, there were dazzling breakthroughs in artificial intelligence theory. We had the first machines, for example, that could play chess and checkers, not very well, but they could at least play the game. They could solve simple algebra theorems. They could even play doctor to a degree and do simple diagnoses. And there were all these fantastic predictions that just within a few years, humans will be put in a zoo. We'll all be zoo animals, and our creations will throw peanuts at us and make us dance behind bars, because look at how fast computers are learning. And then there was the movie 2001. And, well, the year 2001 came and went, and we still do not have the robot Hal, the murderous robot in Arthur C. Clarke's famous movie that could pilot a spaceship, could play chess, and interact with humans as if it was a human itself. So the question is, what happened to the dream of the 1950s and 60s when everyone was predicting that humans would be obsolete by the 1970s?
Well, your observation is correct. I would say wasn't everyone predicting that. There were some famous predictions from Simon and Newell at Carnegie Mellon, which came into disrepute. But there was over-optimism because machines were doing adult activities, like solving some unsolved theorems from Russell and Whitehead, and doing these adult activities, playing chess, in some narrow cases, making medical diagnoses as well as doctors and so on. So it seemed it wouldn't be long before a computer could do everything. Another 10 years went by, and we realized that computers, while they were able to do these sort of high-level analytic tasks, were not able to do some things that a four-year-old can do, which is, let's say, tell the difference between a dog and a cat or recognize faces. And this is really a fundamental issue, in my view, that the fundamental basis of human intelligence is not analytic, logical thinking. And in fact, machines can do that a lot better than humans in most cases. The fundamental basis of human intelligence is pattern recognition. We can see that in the contrast with how machines play chess, which is this minimax combinatorial expansion of move counter moves, which it does largely through brute force. We can look at millions or even hundreds of millions of board positions in a second. Kasparov says he looks at less than one board position in a second, but humans use their tremendous powers of pattern recognition to recognize situations they've thought about before. And we don't think fast enough. Our inner neuronal connections compute 200 calculations per second, which is about 10 to 100 million times slower than electronic circuits, but we have 100 trillion of them, all computing simultaneously, self-organizing. Information is really represented as a pattern. No key connection is all that important. It's a very different paradigm from computers we're used to, and it's a very good architecture for recognizing patterns in a profound way. That is really the heart of human intelligence. Now, we have been making steady progress in pattern recognition. I could give many examples of that, both in terms of recognizing language and speech. Character recognition have all improved gradually. Even in chess, machines have become better qualitative players. So you have Deep Fritz and the current programs working actually as well as Deep Blue, despite the fact that they're about 100 times slower, because they're doing a better job of pattern recognition. So we are making steady progress on that, and that is really the key issue now. And part of the guidance we'll get in terms of creating the templates of pattern, human-level pattern recognition is to actually understand how humans do it, which brings up the issue of reverse engineering the human brain. It wasn't long ago before people were saying, well, you know, our intelligence is just below the level necessary to actually understand our own intelligence. But what we're finding is that as we're able to actually instrument the brain and see what's going on, and our ability to scan the human brain and to actually see the connections and the firings of neuronal connections and synapses is increasing, actually doubling every year, we are able to develop very detailed mathematical models of neurons and neuron clusters. Lloyd Watts and his colleagues have actually created a reverse engineering of the whole acoustic area of the brain involving 12 different regions with a great deal of detail, have re-implemented that in software and submitted that to psychoacoustic tests, which performs very comparably to human auditory perception. If you follow all the exponential trends in computation, communication, brain scanning, exponentially growing knowledge of the human brain, it's, I think, conservative to say we will have reverse engineered the principles of operation of the human brain within a quarter century. And that will provide us, you know, more powerful, biologically inspired methods for pattern recognition.
Okay, well, we've had several AI specialists on the radio show before, among them Rodney Brooks of MIT, the director of the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And I asked him a key question, and that is, well, how powerful are the MIT robots? And he was very proud to say that he's the godfather of the Mars rover, an advanced robot which actually wandered on the surface of Mars. But he was honest and said that his most advanced robots have the intelligence of a cockroach. In fact, cockroaches do it a lot better, he said. Cockroaches can scope out environments, see obstacles, boulders, maneuver around them, and they're quite good at this. And robots at Carnegie Mellon and Stanford, well, when they walk down the hall, it's lucky if they don't gouge out a piece of the wallpaper when they walk down the hallway. So how smart are our robots? Are our robots really so dumb that they are really insect level at the present time, barely able to understand chairs, tables, the ceiling, the roof, people maneuvering around the room? How smart are the robots today?
Well, robots and artificial intelligence in general are operating far below biological levels, both in terms of hardware and software, and I think it's worthwhile talking about both of those, but also to understand that we're making exponential progress in both of these realms. And exponential progress really sneaks up on you. And just to use an analogy, Kasparov played the best machines in the 1990s at chess, and they were pathetic, and he scoffed at them. And it was just inconceivable that they would ever reach his level. But they gradually got better. They're doubling in performance every year, gaining 40 chess points every year, and chess scale is exponential. And then they surpassed him, operating at or beyond his level by 1997. We'll see the same thing in other areas. And it's easy to lose sight of tremendous power of exponential growth. We are doubling computation at least every year, and we'll talk a little bit later about the issue of Moore's Law, but I believe that this phenomenon will continue past Moore's Law into three-dimensional computing. And in terms of software, we're making exponential progress, as I mentioned, in understanding and reverse engineering the principles of operation of the human brain. There's a new brain scanning method now that's being developed, which will be available within a couple of years, that will actually be able to see individual nerve fibers firing in a cluster of thousands of neurons at very high resolution, very high resolution also in terms of time scale, which will really give us the means to reverse engineer those circuits. I mean, so far, we've been really unable to see what's going on. It's very hard to diagnose a circuit if you can't instrument it, but if you can put sensors on in the right place and see what's going on, it's very straightforward to reverse engineer. The human brain, of course, is created by a genome that doesn't have very much information in it. Even though the human brain itself appears to contain thousands of trillions of bytes, the genome only has about 12 million bytes of information to characterize the initial design of the brain, because there's a lot of random wiring in the way it's actually constructed, which then self-organizes to reflect its experience with the world. So the principles of operation are of a complexity that we can't understand, and that will provide us at least biologically inspired paradigms for the software of intelligence. So the capabilities of all of these systems will improve quite steadily, and we will master different levels of biological intelligence. Ultimately, I believe within less than three decades, by 2029, these machines will be operating at human levels and will combine human levels of intelligence, the subtlety and suppleness of human pattern recognition with some of the natural advantages of machines, most notable of which is the ability to instantly share knowledge.
Now let's talk a little bit about Moore's Law, the doubling time you mentioned of 18 months for computers, meaning that at Christmas time, your computers are almost twice as powerful as they were the previous Christmas. Exponential growth in bacteria, for example, eventually seals off, otherwise bacteria would take over the entire planet Earth. And exponential factors do taper off because of external effects. Now, with Moore's Law and computers, the engine driving Moore's Law is ultraviolet etching technology, by which we can etch tinier and tinier transistors on a silicon wafer the size of your thumb. But eventually, the transistors get so tiny, you hit the quantum theory. And at that point, you get short circuits. Leakage takes place. All hell breaks loose. And by 2020, all bets are off. The Intel, one of the senior engineers at Intel, admitted recently in a major paper that, yes, they can see the end of the tunnel. And that is, at a certain point, it's going to be prohibitively difficult to etch silicon components that are tinier and tinier, and eventually you get leakage because you don't know where the electrons are. Some people have said, let's make three-dimensional cubes. But the problem there is you have heat generation, enormous quantities of heat generated in three-dimensional cubes. So the question is, what happens after 2020 when all hell breaks loose and Silicon Valley becomes a rust belt?
Well, it's a key question. And to examine that, I've done a number of things. I have been an ardent student of technology trends. I've been measuring the actual power of different technologies for 25 years. Have a team of people doing that. One thing I did is put 49 famous computers over the last century, long before there was a Moore's Law, on an exponential chart. And this exponential growth has been going on not just for Moore's Law, but back through five different paradigms. Moore's Law, the shrinking of transistors on a flat integrated circuit, was not the first, but the fifth paradigm to provide exponential growth to computing. And every time one paradigm ran out of steam, because as you correctly point out, every method of exponential growth eventually runs out of capacity. Rabbits in Australia eat up the vegetation and stop growing exponentially, even reverse direction. Every time that happened, another paradigm came along and started another S-curve of exponential growth. They were shrinking vacuum tubes to make to continue exponential growth. Finally, they couldn't shrink them anymore and keep the vacuum. That paradigm ended. Transistors came along. And the next paradigm will be three-dimensional computing. We live in a three-dimensional world. Our brain's organized in three dimensions. Our brain, by the way, uses a very cumbersome, very slow electrochemical information processing method that's 200 calculations per second. They're digitally controlled analog transactions, but they're roughly comparable to calculations, at least 10 million times slower than electronic circuits. But it gets its tremendous power from the fact that it's organized in three dimensions. Now, the brain itself is an existence proof of the feasibility of organizing circuits in three dimensions and dealing with the heat problem. I proposed three-dimensional computing as the sixth paradigm to replace Moore's Law, which was the fifth paradigm in my book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, 4 years ago. It was considered a radical notion then. I would say it's much more of a mainstream expectation at this time. There's been tremendous progress in building working three-dimensional circuits over the last 4 years. It's been a steady flow of breakthroughs, including conceptual examinations of this thermal issue that you alluded to. And there are ways of designing the circuits in porous ways to deal with the heat issue. 1 watt of power, which would not generate that much heat, would be sufficient to emulate human brain capacity in a cube that would be very tiny. So the thermal issue is, in fact, a key challenge, but there's a lot of confidence that that's feasible. And we still have at least a dozen years to go. And what we've seen typically is when the end is in sight for a particular paradigm, it creates tremendous pressure in the R&D community to create the next paradigm. And we have a lot of advance warning this time. And already, in fact, just using conventional lithography and going to the third dimension, because after all, even conventional circuits have 14 or 15 layers of material, so they do have some three-dimensional capacity. And there's been successful efforts to build circuits with dozens and even up to 100 layers of circuitry just using conventional techniques. There are many different approaches. The most effective appears to be carbon nanotubes, which is what I had predicted in my book 4 years ago.
Okay. Well, the heat problem, as you mentioned, is quite fierce. Engineers tell me that very soon, even cubicle computers will generate so much heat you can fry an egg on them. Let me ask you a question about the top up, the top-down approach and the bottom-up approach. When we had Rodney Brooks on the radio, he said that there are two approaches to artificial intelligence, top-down and bottom-up. The top-down approach has dominated AI research for the last several decades, and the goal there is to have a CD-ROM with all the laws of common sense, all the laws of logic on it. You simply put the CD-ROM in a computer, and all of a sudden your computer says, I think, I am aware, I am conscious, okay, I'm alive. That's the top-down approach, which failed rather miserably. We know that there are hundreds of millions of lines of common sense. We can't put them on a CD-ROM. There's so many of them. The other one is a bottom-up approach, which follows nature, Mother Nature, allowing machines to learn like bugs, like infants, to bump into the environment. And that approach is like a neural network approach. So could you explain to us a little bit about neural network theory? And this, of course, means that our brain, in some sense, is not really a digital computer at all, that perhaps we were sort of misled over the last 50 years in terms of the successes of silicon, but the brain is really a neural network and not really a Turing machine at all. Could you elaborate?
Well, I've always been a strong advocate of what you're referring to as the bottom-up approach. As I mentioned earlier, the brain, the design of it, characterized by only about 12 million bytes of compressed information in the genome. You might wonder, how could that be when the brain itself contains millions of times more information than that? And the way it works is the genome specifies a particular design, but in a particular region, the actual wiring of the connection is random within certain constraints. And we know that that's the case, having watched how that process unfolds, then there's actually kind of an evolutionary process where the connections that make the most sense in the environment survive, and it's actually twice as many connections in the newborn baby's brain as exists a year later. There's a lot of self-organization. And the brain has the capacity to interact with its environment, make sense of the environment, as well as make sense of its own design and its own interconnections, actually continually being repruned and reconnected to make sense of the environment and to learn. And that is really the only approach that's going to work. I mean, I think the Psych Project of Doug Lanat is interesting. It's accomplished a lot, but I never felt that we could build human-level intelligence that way. We really have to build it the way nature builds it, which is a machine that has the capacity to learn, and then provide for its education. Now, neural nets is sort of one attempt based on a crude model of how human neurons work, which actually builds lots of neuron simulators and connects them somewhat the way the brain connects them and let them self-organize. And there's a number of different approaches to neural nets. They're all very simplified from what we now know is true of actual neurons. And as we're as progress in reverse engineering the human brain progresses and we have more sophisticated and realistic models of actual neurons, we can build more realistic, biologically inspired paradigms. But in general, pattern recognition, which is my field, works by emulating nature in these self-organizing methods. We set up some approach, which could be a neural net, this thing called Markov models, which is a mathematical cousin of neural nets. They're evolutionary algorithms that actually emulate evolution. And actually, part of human learning has a kind of an evolutionary process take place inside the brain, where the better connections that survive. And we use these techniques in our pattern recognition approach. We'll actually stimulate evolution, have different solutions to a problem, compete with each other through thousands of generations of stimulated evolution. And these biologically inspired methods are very powerful. They give results that are essentially unpredictable.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And our special guest today was Ray Kurzweil of Google, also author of the bestseller, The Singularity is Near, about the future of society, the future of artificial intelligence, and the future of humanity. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.